All right. So, study, and you can see how we're on our title slide here, Bible Overview in 40 Points. It's been a little bit since I reviewed some of these points, so I thought I didn't really actually think of it in relation to the start of school here, but hey, school starts tomorrow here at our school. Quiz time, pop quiz. Okay. Let's see how you do on this. So I'm going to go to my next slide here. All right. Now, I won't put you on the spot publicly. I'll put you on the spot in your own mind. So you can think to yourself if you know the next point, and you can grade your own and see how you do. So we are in point Roman numeral 5 of our study. So far the Roman numerals, they're sets of 6. So here we have 6 points, Bible overview in 40 points. All right, here we go. What's the first one? Probably most people are going to get that one. You feel free to say it out loud if you want, but okay. Now, if you missed that one, it's all downhill from here, so it's not going to get any easier than that. Okay. All right. Second one. We have the fall. Yeah, Moses will come later. Okay. And then, so now we can look at the passages here. So, and we think of Genesis chapter 4. And what do we have there? Okay. Well, this is when we start to see, yeah, the growth of sin, both with Cain and Abel. Abel's murder, and just the growth of sin going through mankind, really doing poorly. So then we go into mankind being judged by that. Point number 4, the flood. Point number 5, and 5 and 6 really going together, the establishment of nations. Point number 6, the Tower of Babel. So, okay, so now we've revealed the first 6 points that are here. So now we go into our second Roman numeral. Okay, it's a second set of 6 points. Beginning of Israel. Okay, now if you don't quite remember what the points are, I'll give you a hint. Founding fathers. Okay, so everyone probably, just like the preceding 6, okay, if you don't get this first one, you're not going to get the rest. Okay, the founding father, the first one you ought to think of, Abraham. Or as when I was a kid, we sang a song sometimes, Father Abraham had many sons. Well, here he is. Okay. And probably you're guessing the founding fathers. And after that, points 8, Isaac. Point 9, Jacob. Point 10, Joseph. Okay. Oh, it got hard again. What comes after Joseph? Okay. Well, after Joseph, they were in Egypt 430 years. And then point number 12, Moses. We got to Moses now. Okay, we'll stop for a second there and just let that digest in your mind a little bit. One of the goals I have for our course here is that we're learning these 40 points, and they become kind of an outline for us, an outline of the Bible in 40 points. Okay? All right, so now I'm going to click to my next slide. Okay? That'll reveal the next 12 points, because I didn't want to take 20 minutes reviewing all of them like I just did the first 12. Okay? But now we can look at the next set, points 13 through 24, Roman numeral 3 here, leaders in Israel. Okay? And, of course, this is after they come back into the promised land. Moses passes off the scene. Now you got the time of Joshua and Judges. Pardon me? Yeah, I don't mind printing for you if you want a printout of these things. I'd be happy to. And I do frequently come back to these and review them. So if you didn't get all the points today, they will be regularly reviewed in the future. So yeah, you don't have to worry about it if you can't quite get them all down. So if you want that copy, though, what I ask of you is that you remind me. So that way it's not on me to remember. What's that? Today. Yeah, after we're done here, I'll print them off for you. Yeah. Okay. So so we have the leaders in Israel going from Joshua all the way to Samuel, the man of transition, the last prophet that acted as a leader in Israel. It was really a theocracy at this point, and Samuel was God's mouthpiece and representative. But then Israel demanded a king, so we have the time of the kings, Saul, David, and Solomon, each reigning for 40 years. Then we go to point 19, Solomon's son, Rehoboam, poor leadership, causes a civil war split. I mean, actually, they avert a civil war because he decides under counsel from men of God not to try to have a civil war. That's not all Rehoboam's fault, because part of this was punishment on things that Solomon did with the idolatry, some of the idolatry and things that Solomon brought in. Okay, all right, then you get the schism, point 20 and point 21, 10 tribes defect to the north and 2 to the south. So then you have the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah with their capitals. And then point number 24, 20 rulers each in the north and the south. All in the north are evil, is how God describes them. And many are evil in the south, but not all. Okay, so then that will take us to our next slide. And this is the set of points that we're on currently. So Roman numeral 5, the painful end. Okay, well, this is exactly what God said would happen. He warned Israel that if they broke the covenant that they had with God, there was a consequence for that. And so he was very specific on that. And that's, that's the kind of God we have. He doesn't give us things that he holds us accountable for. But, well, let me back that up and say that differently. He doesn't have things he holds us accountable for, but doesn't tell us what they are. So he is very clear in his word of God how we should live as a Christian. But he's also clear that there are consequences to that. In part, one of the principles in the Word of God is that sin itself has consequences. Okay? Be sure your sin will find you out, the Scriptures tell us. And so, what a man sows, that shall he also reap. So it's still true today. But for Israel, some of them were specific, because Israel was a special setup. It was God's chosen nation, his chosen people, and there was a special arrangement with them that had some aspects to it that aren't directly related to us as non-Jews. But still the principles apply. Okay, so I'm looking at Roman numeral 5, the painful end, and we've already done the first two. Okay? Assyria scatters Israel, so in the year 722 B.C., the northern 10 tribes are conquered. God allows them to be conquered sooner than the southern tribes, in part because he gives mercy to the southern tribes because of kings like Josiah, who actually were godly and who did what was right. And so as we looked at, I think last time, under Josiah, he told Josiah by way of a prophet, Judah's not going to get out of the punishment. They have a lot of evil that's gone on. They're going to get punished, but for your sake, it's not going to happen in your lifetime. You don't have to watch it happen. And so Assyria scatters Israel first, 722 B.C., and then a little over 100 years later, it happens to Judah. So point number 26, Babylon captures Judah in three waves. Okay, so the first wave happens 606 to 605 B.C., I don't say it that way because we don't know which it is. More like things start then, sort of like COVID-19. Did you know how COVID-19 for us happened mostly in 2020? It's kind of like that. Like it began in 2019 and they named it after that when they first figured out something's going on. But for most of us, we lived it in 2020 and fortunately we're still living it now. And, I don't know how long it's going to last. So 606 to 605 were a lot of the conflicts that were going on when Nabopolassar was king of Babylon. But he was doing some co-ruling with his son Nebuchadnezzar. And so Nebuchadnezzar was doing a lot of the leading of the armies against Judah and the interaction. And so from the Bible standpoint, you read about Nebuchadnezzar You don't read about his dad, Nabal Pulaster, at all, and that's the reason. Nebuchadnezzar is the one that, in fact, is doing a lot of the decision-making and the ruling in relation to what's going on from Judah's perspective. So Nebuchadnezzar comes in, and there's a first wave of deportation that happens in 605 B.C., and Daniel is amongst those who are deported at that time. Two more waves, 597 B.C., and then 586 B.C. I've seen also with the 586, some talk about 587, I still think it's kind of in that range where they're, you know, it's not all a one-day event and you're done. I mean, most of the time when I hear people teaching on the topic, 586 B.C. is the one that we tend to focus on more. It's probably the final end of that wave of deportations and the events that are surrounding it. Okay? All right. Well, these other points that are on this slide here for point number five, the painful end, well, we're doing number 27 today, and then I won't talk a lot about the other ones that are there, but we'll do the 7 years of Babylonian captivity, and then the next point after that is returning from captivity into the promised land. Okay, well, let's go to our next slide now. Okay, so I put this one up because I was kind of thinking after last week I didn't really have any maps there, and I thought, you know what, I'd just like to have a map up there for a little bit. Some people are lovers of geography and maps, and some people are not. So some people don't care about this stuff, some people do. So maybe you envisioned where Egypt was last week when I was talking about Egypt and the conflict between Egypt and Babylon, and how Israel was between the two. But if you couldn't visualize that, hey, let me put up a map this week. And so, well, actually, I was going to step over there, but let me stay in view of the camera and just use my pointer here. So Egypt is down here. Okay, and a little bit hard to see on the pictures here, but you can see this blue line. The Euphrates and the Tigris River provide, you know, kind of basic boundaries of Mesopotamia and Babylon. Babylon is a city down here in the southern part of that. So this is Babylon. Now, prior to that, Assyria had been dominant power. That location, that's a little more to the north there. But Babylon conquered and replaced Assyria. Its capital city is Nineveh. Of course, you recognize that from the story of Jonah, if you're familiar with the book of Jonah. That happened before. Now, Nineveh is not the influential world capital that it was because Assyria has been conquered and replaced by Babylon. So remember, Assyria in the north, they're the ones that conquered the northern kingdoms of Israel, which if you locate on the map here under the name Syria, the name Damascus, which is the capital of Syria, that was the kingdom to the north of Israel. Well, the northern ten tribes are right below that, kind of like where you see that box there, 539 B.C., so in that area. The southern kingdom of Judah is down where Jerusalem's at. Israel's quite tiny. I don't know if everyone's ever paid attention to the size of Israel. Quite tiny. Most of us, I think, have been around long enough to know that the western states, the United States, are quite large compared to the eastern states. And I remember coming across Texas once on I-10. We were in Texas forever. It's like, when are we ever going to get out of this state? Because when you're driving cross-country, you feel like you're making progress when you go through several states in a day. But when you're in the same state all day long and you still don't get out of it, next day you got to start in the same state again. That's long. So I read, yeah. Covered wagon, yeah.
In the east, you can
go up and
like 3 or 4 states in the same day.
Yeah, yeah. So Israel is very small compared to California. Very small. I don't know what it would compare to, but it kind of feels like maybe like a Maryland, a Delaware. I don't even think it's as big as New Jersey, but, you know, so it's kind of on the smaller side. You notice the location of Israel there along the Mediterranean coast. It's between Egypt and Babylon. And it's strategically located along the coast where you could have port cities for shipping. It's also like land routes that could pass through there to get over to other areas. Down below that, where you got this title, the Captivity of Judah, that's like Saudi Arabia area, the Arabian Desert. I think a lot of the land routes didn't go through there. They went around the desert as opposed to having to go through the desert. So a lot of the land routes go up through Israel, continue on up and over this kind of orangish, reddish-orange streak here. I don't actually know what they intended this to be on there, but I'm guessing the Fertile Crescent, because that, you know, is an area, as the name implies, it's more fertile area. And so a lot of the things traveled through there. Of course, the kingdom of Syria didn't get out of this either. So Syria and Israel were both involved in problems with these foreign nations that looked at where their location and their land and the strategic resources that were there and wanted control over it. So we talked last week how Babylon was able to get control over this area, and Egypt kind of fades in its importance as a world power and doesn't really ever recoup from that, even to the present day. Prior to that, they had been one of the major world powers, but they lose several battles against Babylon and fall. Okay, Israel, though, doesn't always want to go along with that. And so at times they're in conflict with Babylon. Eventually Babylon, I think, just gets tired of it. That third wave of deportation, that's it. They sack Jerusalem, destroy the temple, carry off their leadership into captivity. They'd already done it two times before. So the many of the leaders are over in Babylon area. Now, the northern tribes, many of them had been carried off as well, captives into the Assyrian Empire, and settled and lived there. What do these foreign nations do with these leaders? If you have in your mind dungeons and, you know, jails and things like that, well, I don't know. I suppose that was true for some of them. We know some of the kings were, it would have been bad to be the king, as we read with King Zedekiah, I believe, whereas they killed his sons in front of him, then gouged out his eyes and let him off in handcuffs, basically, I mean, whatever their ways of binding someone, and let him off into captivity. So that would happen to some, but many others, they were looking for the skilled people, I think, to basically go work now for Babylon and produce things for them. And so I figured what I'd do here is talk a little bit about, you know, what this time period of these 70 years. Let's go to our next slide and take a peek at this before we talk more about that time period. Okay, so I just thought this slide here, titled Chronological Order of Books, that this slide was kind of interesting. Maybe helps us organize the Bible books a little bit more in our mind. Okay, and so we see here that we have the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus doesn't there, but that, oh, there it is down there. Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. It's sort of like a timeline here chronologically, so you have the books of the law. Job is thought to be the oldest book in the Bible, and the time period that it took place would have predated Moses and predated Israel. So then it continues on, Joshua, Judges, and you've got the time of the kings. So kind of look around here, look above 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. That's when a lot of the prophets were ministering here. And that's organized showing where the prophets tend to minister. Amos and Hosea ministering in the northern 10 tribes. Okay, a number of prophets focusing on the southern tribes of Judah. Okay. Some focus on foreign nations, like Jonah being sent to Nineveh to preach to Nineveh. And then if we go down below 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles overlaps those and provides a lot of similar information. during that time period, especially about the kings. That's what the name comes from, their chronicles, that is, their writings. So they're the chronicles what? They're the chronicles of the kings, and record a lot of information on what took place up to the captivity. And you go down below there, there's other books of the Bible that are written in this time period. Like, you know, King David wrote a lot of the Psalms. King Solomon wrote Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. Ruth lived during the time of the Judges. Okay, now we come in the middle of this here where you got a break between 2 Kings and Ezra, and that's the 70 years of exile. During that 70 years of exile, two prophets are ministering during that time, Daniel and Ezekiel. They're in exile. So both of them live outside the nation of Israel at this point. And it's thought that Daniel never did return Israel. He was in exile, went into exile in 605 BC as a very young man, probably a teenager, perhaps even on the younger side of being a teenager. And then lived in Babylon, likely, the rest of his life. But lived long enough to see Israel come back after 70 years of captivity. By Israeli tradition, they believe that he stayed there and did not return with the group. Perhaps because of his, you know, roles that he had in influence and advisory roles for the kings that were over there, and maybe stayed there because of that. Okay, and then, of course, after that, Israel is going to come out. The books of Ezra and Nehemiah are very important for understanding that time period. And there's another name that would be good to associate. It's not a book named, there's not a book of the Bible named after him, but Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel helps to come and rebuild the temple, and Ezra is involved in that. And a lot of the rebuilding of the temple is discussed in the book of Ezra when they're allowed to come back again. And then Nehemiah, the book of Nehemiah, is a lot of the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem during that time. So I'm not going to get into that. That's the next point in our study. And there were prophets that ministered. So I'm looking at Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, prophets that ministered after the return from captivity. Okay, again, those are future lessons, so we won't get into that. But I thought this slide helps kind of, you know, get a feel again or remind us maybe things we already knew or things that might be new to you. So let's come back to this 70 years of exile, 70 years in captivity. Let's look at that a little bit by going to our next slide. Okay, title on this slide, 70 years dash timeline. Now, there's some things about this slide that I'm not a big fan of, meaning that there's probably other information I would like on it, but here's something I do like about this slide, is it shows four dates. So you'll see on the left, as I said, 606 to 605 BC was that year of the first deportations, and that's when Daniel would have been carried off. Okay, let's, you know, look on the left side, 606. Let's come to the next date, 586. That's the third wave of deportations, and that's when the temple's destroyed and when the walls of Jerusalem are seriously damaged, broken down. Okay, let's go. Keep going to the right to the next date. In 536 BC, we have a decree by Cyrus, king of Persia. Now, by this point, Babylon has been conquered and replaced by Persia, or sometimes referred to the Medes and the Persians, because there's two people groups that kind of made up that empire. So in 536 BC, there's a decree by Cyrus that allows for the temple to be rebuilt. And so temple construction starts after that decree. Okay, then 20 years later, in 516, so moving all the way to the right, the completion of the temple being rebuilt in 516 BC. Okay, now what I like about this is if we think about the 70 years of captivity, remember the scriptures reveal to us that God sent them into captivity for 70 years because Israel had not honored God in its Sabbath years. Okay, so we understand the concept of a Sabbath day as the last day of the week, Saturday, the seventh day of the week, as being a day of rest. They're described in the Law of Moses. But there was also described in the Law of Moses a Sabbath year where the land would get rest once every 7 years. And for 490 years, Israel had not honored that. And so God said, I'm going to get them back. Okay, so 490 years divided by 7 is 70. So God says, I want all those Sabbaths back. So I'm taking back my 70 years now. Oh, it should have been done once every 7 years through that period. I'm getting them back now. And so the land had rest for 70 years. Now, it's not, you know, it's not that the people didn't do any farming or anything, but this captivity is kind of a replacement and a punishment at the same time for those Sabbath years that they never honored God in. Now, when were those Sabbath years? From when to when? Okay. Well, most of the time when I've heard Bible teachers speak on this, they speak of it being from 586 to 516. And if you do the subtraction here, that's 70 years. Okay, and so you can see that whoever produced this particular slide that I found on the internet goes with that thought. 70 years of captivity from 586 to 516. Okay, but I have seen some who propose that the 70 years is from 606 to 536. That's also a 70-year period. And this particular slide also points out that that's 70 years, but this, whoever made this slide talks about those Sabbath years being from here to here. So, well, God doesn't tell us how he defines the beginning and end of the 70 years. He says, I'm taking back 70 years of Sabbaths. So I don't know how important that is, but I think it's interesting, though, an interesting confirmation that God kept his word. And there was some logic even behind why he chose 70 as years of captivity. But, of course, he was punishing them, as he said he would do if they did not obey and follow. All right. So we're not going to do a lot more with that slide. And for the sake of those that are helping me inside with PowerPoint slides, I'm not doing a lot more with PowerPoint slides from this point forward. What I would like to do is I would like to just highlight some things. I'm going to highlight some stories from the book of Daniel. Now, Jeff's going to cover for me next week, but I was doing a little, when I was doing some talking with you recently, I decided, you know what, sounds like this will work fine. I'm going to do some of the things out of the book of Daniel, and then we'll take over after that and probably focus on the coming out and the return. After that. So, all right. So in the book of Daniel, Daniel chapter 1, verse 1, I'm going to highlight three stories out of the book of Daniel that I think will give us a little bit of feel for this time period of the 70 years of exile. Also, there's some lessons that we're going to draw out of these particular passages. And I think the lessons that we can draw out of them are very helpful to us in our current society and the times in which we live. If I were to highlight those lessons, I might say them this way. Like the times of Daniel, you and I live amongst people that don't love God. And just as he had to navigate being a Christian in his society, we have to navigate being a Christian in our society. And so there are lessons we can learn from Daniel about how to live in a society that is not a godly society. And King Nebuchadnezzar, I don't believe, was a Christian. Now, there's some question on that because there's times where he seems like he repents, especially when God changes his mind to the heart of kind of like a wild beast where I never figured out exactly what it was like, moment of insanity or some sort of disorder that caused him to behave abnormally. We think maybe that leaders and so forth hid that from a lot of the population. Probably a lot of the population didn't know what was going on with him, much like people are protecting Biden and not letting him do interviews and things so as not to expose what would happen if you turned him loose. So anyways, though, you get at the end of that story, Nebuchadnezzar acknowledges God as the God that was the most high God. And did he actually repent and become a Christian? I don't know. I hope so. But he prior to that event, he oftentimes referred to God as a true God. And I think that's probably a polytheistic thought in a lot of those where he, you know, said, oh, yeah, that's a true God. But he still had his own gods he worshipped, and it wasn't necessarily a repentance in his heart and a turning to God for salvation. Well, let's begin in Daniel chapter 1, the first of three events that I think we can learn some lessons for. And for sake of time, we're going to go through these rather quickly. But in chapter 1, verse 1, that's where you read that Daniel was deported along with Jehoiakim, king of Judah. So that's one verse that tells us when he got deported. That's how we know it was in 605 B.C. And so then many of those that were leaders were carried off into Babylon. And then in verse 3, the king spoke to Ashpenaz, the master, one of the leaders in the house. The eunuchs would have been servants that served in the palace. And Ashpenaz is the head of these guys, palace servants. And basically tells him, I want you to take certain of the children of Israel, verse 3, certain of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well favored, verse 4, skillful in wisdom, cunning in knowledge. Okay, so what's the summary here? Take some of these very promising, very talented young men, and what I want you to do with them, verse 5, is I want you to give them the best health care and the best diet. I want these guys in top shape. Okay? Well, this is not, again, this is an example where these guys weren't thrown into dungeons and, you know, treated like prisoners. So he's going to put these guys to work for himself. And so he's taken the best of the best. These are the guys that could have got into MIT, into Stanford. That from a human standpoint had all the things that the king was looking for. Okay, and among these, we're told in verse 6, was Daniel. Also Daniel's three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And we see in verse 7 that they're given Babylonian names. Daniel's given a Babylonian name of Belshazzar. Hananiah's given a Babylonian name of Shadrach. Mishael is given a Babylonian name, Meshach, and Azariah is given a Babylonian name of Abednego. Now, for whatever reason, much of the rest of the book of Daniel continues to refer to Daniel by his Hebrew name, but much of the rest of the book of Daniel refers to the other three guys by their Babylonian names. I don't have any point in in pointing that out, except that just seems to be the way it is. So, anyways, in verse 8, Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor the wine which he drank. Some commentators point out that this is not likely to be about Jewish dietary restrictions, because drinking fruit of the vine was not something that would defile you. More likely, this is connected to the idol worship that was going on. And so this was heavily, this would have been almost like participating in their idol worship. And so likely that's what it is. But this much we know for sure, that they believe that this would be improper activity to get involved in as Jehovah worshipers. May I use the word Christian, even though they didn't use that back then. But if we especially apply it to Christians now, there are things that Christians, if they get involved in, really are becoming complicit in ungodly behavior. And so Daniel made a decision and said, I'm not going to do it. Okay? And so one thing I think that can be true of Christians is sometimes if we're not careful, we can excuse being involved in something that's not right with thoughts such as this. Well, if I kind of go along with it and don't really, you know, maybe participate some. And like here, I mean, you're with Daniel, you know, okay, I know, the food's just food. The wine's just, you know, it's what it is. I know those things themselves. There's nothing wrong in that. We could even have our minds turn to the book of Romans chapter 14, where Paul addressed some of those. He says, I know that the meat offered to idols is just meat. Okay, and Paul said, you know, I think I could eat that, no problem. Okay, I believe suggested in this, or maybe implied in this, is the likelihood that what Paul was speaking of, Paul didn't go down and join in the dedication of the meats or join in the idolatrous behavior. And I think likely there's something to that effect here with Daniel. But we see here a principle of this that we could emulate. Daniel said to himself, this is going to defile me. I don't think this is good. And so he purposed, I'm not going to do it. So that's, I think, a good example for us to consider, not to defile ourselves by joining in things that would not honor God. And again, in the Romans passage with Paul, he wasn't suggesting go ahead and join in things that don't honor God. He was saying, you know, if you buy that meat in the marketplace and bring it home to your house, it may have been offered idols over there, but in my house, I'm just having a steak dinner. I'm not joining in anything that's not God-honoring. So I think we want to be careful not to justify joining in activities that God considers dishonorable to him. And so Daniel purposed that he would not do that. And so the book of 1 Corinthians chapter 10, several verses surrounding verse 20 discuss this issue. Paul says in verse 14, flee idolatry. And then down a little bit further in verse 20, but I say that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to devils and not to God. And I would not that ye should have fellowship with devils. Don't get involved in that. That's kind of like what Daniel was thinking. He wasn't going to get involved in this that he felt would defile him. Okay? And so Daniel had this resolution. So that's one lesson. Okay, so let's move on beyond that. Okay. And in verse 10, the prince of the eunuchs says, I'm afraid because I've been given a task by the king, and if I don't get the job done right, I'm in trouble. So Daniel then has a conversation in verse 11 with a man named Melzar. Melzar is the prince of the eunuchs, whom the prince of the eunuchs set over him. So now the guy who was in charge that Daniel was first talking to puts another guy over Daniel and his three friends. And to them, Daniel says, hey, what if we do it this way? How about a 10-day test? And we're going to let us eat things that are not going to defile us. The Bible here in the King James refers to it as pulse and water, likely some sort of like a vegetable dish of some kind, maybe like a vegetable soup or something like that. And the guy agrees to that because this is kind of a safe way of maybe trying this without getting into trouble, because 10 days is a short time period. And at the end of 10 days, they pass the test and they feel good about it. Well, one lesson I think is in here. In fact, let me read about this. I just got to see where I have it.
I like the way the prince of the eunuchs put it, that you shall make me endanger my head to the king.
Yeah. Yeah, cause, and literally, that was a real fear of being executed. Yeah, in danger of my head. Well, one commentator says this, as Daniel purposed in his heart, on principle, that he was not going to do it, he designed, and I'm quoting here, he designed to secure his object, if possible, by making a request. Later, he says, he wished not to give offense or to provoke opposition. Then later, the same commentator says, if he had not obtained permission, we know not, or we're not certain, but the probability is that he would have thrown himself upon the protection of God as he did in Daniel 6. Well, that's the lion's den example. So likely, if he wouldn't have gotten this request, he would have stood his ground and suffered the consequences of it. One of the things I think we can learn here as Christians, sometimes the first step isn't going out and raising ruckus, you know, shouting down, screaming, yelling at local officials or trying to get us to do something that's not a great thing for us as a Christian to do. Some wisdom there, trying to develop a good relationship with the people that we have to be around. So I think there's some wisdom there for us as well, living in a society we're going to be rubbing shoulders with non-Christians. I know an example for myself is last year in school is we interacted with the health department quite a bit on COVID and really worked hard to develop a positive relationship with the health department. No need to make enemies unnecessarily. Let's get on their good side. Let's have a good relationship. Let's see if we can't have things go peacefully and go well. And so I think Daniel did that here. He didn't just, rise up and say, I'm a Christian, I'm not going to do that, you can't make me, and I refuse, and you guys are all going to hell, and I'm on God's side. Well, you hear, and all of us have probably heard examples of Christians behaving that way and saying things that are very combative and just very caustic. And Daniel did not conduct himself that way. Okay, so now we're going to move down to Daniel chapter 3. And by the way, the end result of that, the four guys looked better after 10 days. So, okay. And so God blessed and allowed that to be something where their consciences before God were not going to be defiled. And so, all right. And so then in Daniel chapter 3, we read of an image that Nebuchadnezzar is going to erect. Probably inspired by that dream that was interpreted by Daniel in the previous chapter. But in chapter 3, he erects this image. One source talked about maybe it was the image of a god. Another, in that same source, said it might have been an image of his dad, Nabopolassar. I have often thought of it as his own image. But it doesn't matter. The Bible doesn't really make that clear to us. But there's this really large golden image that's erected, Daniel 3, verse 1. And Nebuchadnezzar has a big, almost like a dedication party to this image. And it says in verse 2 that he calls out all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of this image. Now, it's likely that Daniel's not there. So when it says it called all the rulers, that's kind of a generic statement. It's not meant to be literally every single ruler, so that all other parts of the land had no rulers left anywhere. That would be a very unwise thing to do. But many of the rulers are called there for this dedication. Daniel's likely not there because we don't read about him in this, but Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, I'll go by their Babylonian names because those are the ones I'm more familiar with, they were there. And he has a decree, everyone fall down and worship this image, likely meaning worship it as a god. And these three men are like, we can't do that. And so then there are some in verse 9 that come to the king. And in verse 12, they say there are certain Jews who are not going along with this. They're not going to serve your gods or worship the image that you have set down. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, it says in verse 13, in his rage and fury, he's very angry over this. And so he calls them and questions. Now, at this point, he's very angry, and I think the rage and fury are indicating that. But he hasn't reached the level he's going to reach. So he's still got a little bit of patience with them because he tells them in verses 14 and 15, basically, I'm going to give you a second chance, and I'm going to do it again. I'm going to play, when the instruments start playing, you bow down, you worship. But they don't need a second chance, because they tell him in verse 16, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. Okay, well, the idea of that carefulness not that they are not careful, is basically they don't need more time. The word means that it's not necessary. I'll read here. The meaning, therefore, is that it was not necessary that they should reply to the king on that point. They're not trying to defend their actions. They're not arguing with him over whether they should or shouldn't. They're just saying, we don't really need to discuss this. This is where we're at. This is what we're going to do. We're not trying to tell your, to change. I think they, didn't try to make the case. They're basically not putting up a defense, but we're not going to change. Well, Nebuchadnezzar's really ticked off now. And he is so mad that he cranks up the fiery furnace, which was the punishment if you didn't do this. He had already stated before. He cranks that up so hot that some of his mightiest men, is how it's described, who are tasked with the job of taking him down and throwing him in the furnace, while they're down there, probably getting ready to throw them in, so some of the flames came out, the heat came out, and it killed them. But the three men went in, and then Nebuchadnezzar looks in there and sees four men in there. And one commentator says, describing that fourth one, it was usual among the pagans to suppose that the gods often appeared in human form. And probably Nebuchadnezzar regarded this as some such celestial appearance. So when he says the fourth is like the Son of God, that's not Nebuchadnezzar's way of saying that's Jesus in there. Nebuchadnezzar had no knowledge of Jesus, but like this is like a godlike form in there, So might it have been an angel? Might it have been a Christophany, a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ? Well, is what many have thought over the years. He says that this was the Son of God, the second person of the Trinity, who afterward became incarnate, has been quite a common opinion of expositors. And so, say that's likely, but it could have also been angelic. And they come out of there. Of course, the ropes burned off their hands, and Nebuchadnezzar at one point calls them out of the fire, and God saves them, and they come out. Okay. Well, in like manner to these, and I won't get into this today, is the third example, because I'm out of time, Daniel, in the lion's den. And in similar fashion, standing up and saying, I'm going to do what's right. Now, in that case, the king passed a law. You can't pray to any king. And that was under King Darius, who is under the Medo-Persian Empire. And King Darius was tricked into passing that law that ended up putting his friend, Daniel, in jeopardy of his life. And they had a rule, the law is the law. Even the king can't change it. And even though he labored to do so hard, did not want to see Daniel executed. When Daniel found out what the rule was, you can't pray to anyone else, what did he do? He could have done what many of us as Christians might do, which is, well, I'm going to pray, but I'm just going to do it in secret. He was like, I'm still going to pray to God. I'm not going to hide that I'm a Christian. I'm not going to pretend I'm not. And so the Bible says he went home and with the window shades being open, just like he had always done, he prayed to Jehovah. His enemies knew that they couldn't get him on anything else because he wasn't a corrupt man and he wasn't doing unwise things. So they knew the only way we're going to get this guy is in relation to his religion, because he's very devout, and that's what they were successful in doing, except God preserved him. He didn't die in the lion's den, and his enemies were thrown in there by King Darius. After Daniel came out. I think I've got Darius right, although it might have been Cyrus on that. One of the two. What's that? Okay. Darius. Got it. So I'll try to remember that anytime I'm saying King Darius. Well, let's go ahead and close our time in prayer. We're out of time today, and then Jeff.